Thanks very much, and thanks for the privilege of being here participating to this very important meeting. I should really start my talk with a disclaimer. I'm not a quality assurance specialist. I'm a clinical trial statistician, and so I'm going to look at this issue of quality assurance from a very one-sided view, which is the view of the statistician. So this is the outline of my talk. I'd like to first define data errors and look at why they would matter or why they wouldn't matter in some cases. And then I'll come back to two issues that Rory already touched upon, on-site monitoring and statistical ways to check the data. But the first question I think we should ask ourselves is, why do we want quality assurance in clinical trials? And contrary to what many people believe, the purpose of quality assurance is not to have 100% error-free data. That is not required, it's not useful, it's very costly, and it's not the purpose of quality assurance. The only purpose of quality assurance in clinical trials should be that the observed effect of treatment are real and that their estimated magnitude is unbiased. And in fact, we do not need 100% error-free data to get to that goal. So before I go further, I'd like to look at the types of errors that can occur in a clinical trial and perhaps try to divide them between what I call random errors, and by random I mean random with respect to the assignment of treatment, and systematic errors, i.e. errors that can actually bias the treatment effect. So random errors typically consist of measurement errors, for example, due to the assay precision, or the frequency of visits if you're interested in a time-dependent outcome, errors due to sloppiness, for example, transcription errors from the source data to the case report form, and in fact, many types of fraud, particularly data fabrication, would fall in this group of random errors because they would be unrelated to the treatment the patients receive. And then we have systematic errors, which mostly consist of design flaws, which are avoidable. For example, exclusion of patients after randomization, unequal schedules of visits, etc. And as I said, these can be avoided to a very large extent. And then some types of fraud, which I think are not the most prevalent types of fraud, which really consist of data falsification to get to a certain treatment effect. And these, in multicentric trials at least, tend to be quite rare. I'll come back to that in a moment. But what types of errors matter? Again, it's not usually appreciated by non-statisticians that random errors don't matter very much. And I'd like to just show you a quick example of that, just to make the point that, in fact, if you have some random noise in your data, it really doesn't affect the treatment comparison very much. However, systematic errors do matter, but again, they may be prevented by proper design and analysis. So let me give you an example of these random errors. I took the case of an actual trial published in the New England 2 years ago, and this trial was in patients with age-related macular degeneration. Patients were stratified and then randomized into one of four treatment groups, a group receiving a sham injection and three groups receiving an active drug in the eye. The outcome of the trial was the visual acuity of the patients measured by these visual charts and measured over time repeatedly. So these are the results of the trial depicted graphically. You see the mean visual acuity by treatment group over time, and the solid line is the control group, is the sham group, and then the three dotted lines are the three treatment groups, with the group having the lowest level of the drug showing a large effect on visual acuity. In other words, their visual acuity is not decreasing as much. I'm sorry, the solid line is actually the low dose, and the dotted line at the bottom is the control group. So these patients lose vision more than the treated patients. So look at the p-values of these comparison. Two groups, two doses, had a very high, highly significant effect, and one dose had a just marginally significant effect. So what we did is we took the data, the patient data from this trial, and we just added random errors to these data. We just added normally distributed random errors, and we just increased the proportion of patients in whom we introduced these errors. And then we simulated trials and looked at the distribution of the p-values. So what I show here is the median p-value, and it's plotted against an increasing proportion of patients in whom we introduced the errors. And as you see, if the effect of treatment was significant, quite significant, in fact, it doesn't really matter if we have random errors at all, because all of these treatment comparisons remain significant. It's only for the treatment that is on the top, the blue line on the top there, on the top of the graph that in fact the treatment effect was significant at a 0.03 level, and if we increase the number of patients in whom there is random errors, in fact we lose significant, but we have to go all the way up to 30% of patients with random errors before we lose significance. So even for a marginally significant treatment benefit, adding random errors doesn't matter too much. Now, systematic errors, in contrast, matter a lot. Again, we can avoid them by proper design, and we all know this. We don't exclude patients. We don't do per-treatment-received analyses. We try to have identical follow-up schedules in both treatment groups or the control and the treatment group. We use blinding whenever possible to avoid bias in the assessment of the endpoint, et cetera, et cetera. And then there is this problem of fraud, which Rory already touched upon, which some define as the intention to cheat. Now, in 1999, we wrote a paper that Rory also referred to in Statistics in Medicine, where we tried to find evidence of fraud in the medical literature. And in fact, I found it amazing that it was extremely hard to find any evidence of fraud. In other words, it was very difficult to quantify the phenomenon to see if it was a very common phenomenon or not. And so we looked at some published papers on fraud where there had been a systematic investigation of whether fraud had been committed. And what we found was a relatively low prevalence of fraud in these cases. However, I would take the point that this is probably an underestimation of the phenomenon, simply because fraud is so politically incorrect that if a case of fraud is detected, certainly drug companies are not very happy to publish about it, and they prefer to keep quiet about this. Even if they don't hide it, they would rather not have it publicized unless it goes to the lay press. And if it goes to the lay press, it's out of proportion, and the lay press doesn't understand that many cases of fraud have absolutely no impact on the results of the trial. And that is because many types of fraud introduce random noise again, not systematic errors, but just things that cannot possibly influence the treatment effect. Many cases of fraud also affect secondary variables, not the primary outcome of the trial, but secondary variables, for example, the eligibility criteria, in which case, again, it's very unlikely that they have any effect whatsoever on the main results of the trial. And the magnitude of fraud, certainly in multicentric trials, is very unlikely to have an influence on the overall results. The cases of fraud that are the most worrisome, for example, the fraud in advanced breast cancer with bone marrow transplantation, the Besvoda case, which actually misled the scientific community for a long time, was in fact a special case because that trial was a single-center trial with a few peripheral institutions, but the fraud was really in one major center. So in a multicentric trial where you have a lot of centers, it's very unlikely that fraud will have any impact, sizable impact at least, on the results. However, we need to detect fraud, we need to detect errors, and how can we do it? Well, the traditional method with which people have tried to do it is on-site monitoring. Last year at the 27th meeting of the International Society for Clinical Biostatistics in Geneva, Mats Løstad gave a very good talk on quality assurance in clinical trials, and I've just taken a quote from his presentation where he says something that I think is very true, that a GCP emphasizes clerical problems, clerical errors, and do not emphasize quality assurance in general. I'll come back to that in a moment. But what we need, I think, as far as the evidence, as far as the efficacy or cost-effectiveness of monitoring, is evidence. And I think we lack evidence, in particular randomized evidence, that it serves any useful purpose to do on-site monitoring. So we take it for granted that more monitoring is better than less, but we don't have evidence that that is true. So a few years back, we were involved in a clinical trial, which is depicted here, a phase 4 trial in breast cancer, early breast cancer. Patients were stratified and then randomized between a control group, 6 times FEC, and a treatment group, 4 times FEC and 4 times Taxol. And so this trial was a randomized study, phase 4, done in academic sites. And we actually decided to stratify the sites between a group of sites that would be site visited. In other words, they would have monitoring visits, and another group of sites where there would be no visits whatsoever. The sites were stratified, as you see, by type, location, and then they were allocated to one of these two groups. And in fact, we looked at the effect of initiation visits. By the way, this was published in Clinical Trials last year, if you're interested. We looked at the impact of initiation visits on patient accrual. So this is the result as far as how many patients were randomized in the sites that were site visited, group A, and in the sites that were not site visited, group B. And I think it's obvious from this slide that there was no difference, no impact of initiation visits on the accrual in the sites. Then the impact of initiation visit on the volume of data, the quality of data submitted, again, there is no striking difference. If anything, sites that had no site visits actually submitted more forms, more CRF pages, than those who did have site visits. And finally, the quality of the data. Again, there are a few random variations in these numbers, but it's fair to say that there was absolutely no obvious benefit to the sites having been site visited in terms of the quality of the data they submitted. So I think this is the kind of, I'm not saying that this trial is convincing or definitive, but this is the kind of information I think we need more before we make decisions on site monitoring. Now there is a completely different approach we could take to data checking and quality assurance, is actually to take a statistical view of it. And this statistical view rests on a few principles that I've listed here. The first one is that humans are very poor random number generators. If you invent data, more likely than not, you will not invent random data. So a good software could be able to detect that you invent the data, that the data are not real. They're just invented by someone. Plausible multivariate data are especially hard to fabricate. Even if you can guess the sort of mean of the distribution, you can't guess the correlation between two variables very well. And therefore, it's actually much easier to detect problems, errors, and fraud using multivariate approaches. Clinical trial data are highly structured. It's not often the case in science that we have data sets that are as structured as clinical trial data set, because it's the same repeat of the same experiment using the same protocol in many centers. And that is a very unique way of structuring the data, which is such that we can, in fact, compare the observed data to what we expected and compare one site to all the others. Clinical trial data are rich in meaning, so we can implement plausibility checks. For example, date checks. It's very unlikely that in a clinical trial many patients are randomized on Sundays, for example, or Saturdays if it's Israel, etc. And then finally, it's often the case, if not always the case, that a case of fraud or really gross errors will occur in a few centers, perhaps one only, rather than in all the sites at the same time. So this allows us to take a non-parametric view of the problem, and in fact, to compare each site in turn with all the others, in terms of all the variables collected, and trying to find signals as to whether this site differs from the rest of them. And we can use statistical tests, well-known statistical tests, to do that. The difference between this approach and the approach that is traditionally taken is it's a brute force approach. It doesn't care about the meaning or the plausibility of the data. It just looks at the numbers and tries to see if the numbers make sense. So this approach would yield a very large number of center-specific statistics, which we can keep and then apply meta-statistics to these statistics and try to, again, find signals of fraud or errors based on these large numbers of tests. So we've actually implemented a software to do this, and we're working on it at the moment. We've called it Safe Statistical Alerts for Errors. And in fact, this is a completely automated system that just takes the original data sets, doesn't care about the meaning of the data, prepares the data, and then checks the data by doing all these tests, keep the results in a results data set, and applies the meta statistics on them. Unfortunately, I cannot show you results because we're working on this prototype. But this, I think, is a promising approach to perhaps focus on site monitoring better than we can do at the moment. Now, finally, coming back to the presentation Mats Lerstad gave at ISCB, he took the example of other industries, the nuclear power, the aviation and space industry, to say that, in fact, total quality management had been implemented successfully in these industries. Total quality management requires several things which clinical trial or clinical research doesn't have. We need a working definition of quality. Quality does not mean, again, 100% correctness. It means that the data must be fit for the use we make of them, which is different. We need to implement systems to prevent frauds and errors rather than detect them. And certainly EDC, electronic data capture, is a nice way to do that, in part at least. We need performance data. How do we assess if what we do in clinical trials is any good? We just don't have performance data. At least I don't know of any. We just do trials and hope that we don't have errors, or make sure that we don't have errors, but we don't have any data, any performance indices to compare what we do with some goal. We need a statistical process control, and we need to continuously improve. So in a sense, I think it's fair to say that the clinical research industry is a very pedestrian, old-fashioned, and inefficient industry. Conclusions? I think we lack evidence on the cost-effectiveness of what we do, be it monitoring or other procedures. We do need more data on what we do, more control and more performance data on what we do. A statistical approach to quality assurance is promising. And finally, quality assurance in clinical trials must be re-engineered. I think we must take the problem from scratch rather than have more regulations, which will probably not achieve this goal. Thanks very much for your attention.